I'm going to give you a little report on a visit to Japan. I was teaching at Yoshisha for the spring term. I was a little surprised when a Japanese boy said to me, "Why did you come?" Well, the Japanese are so glad to go to America, I didn't see why he'd have to ask me why I wanted to come to Japan. I told him that I had graduates, both Japanese and American, all over Japan whom I wanted to see, and then I wanted to learn something. I carried my sketchbook everywhere, and one friend said to me, "You better start sketching what strikes your attention immediately, because after 3 or 4 weeks it will not strike your attention. You will take it for granted." There was something in that, and I will therefore begin by that which first struck my attention, and that was traffic. It's appalling. San Francisco is a leisurely relaxation compared with Tokyo or Kyoto. There are, to be sure, some large highways, particularly in those cities which were wrecked by bombs. War does have one advantage, that it enables a city to reconstruct on better lines. But in other cities which were not bombed, like Kyoto, they also have some large highways, but the speed down them, I'm sure, exceeds anything that we allow in this country. Accidents are very carefully planned for if one occurs. The policemen immediately assemble like ants around a piece of sugar. They are in spotless uniforms, but they get down on their knees with chalk and mark all the points where the wheels came to rest. Then the cars are quickly whisked away, and the policemen get out tape measures and measure every spot and make a complete map of the whole thing. It's quite picturesque. But it's not the big avenues of traffic which occasion the difficulty, but the innumerable little alleys. Parking is allowed in the alleys, but they're only about wide enough for Volkswagens to cross, and when Volkswagens are parked on both sides, it's a matter of worming through. In addition to that, there are innumerable motorcycles which go zooming through at an unlimited rate, and of course, pedestrians. Children are taught very early not to get out more than 1 or 2 feet from the wall on the street, and I'm amazed that little children get this so quickly. It gives them very little room for play. They do the sort of thing that can be handled in a small space. You'll see them doing a jump rope or knocking a ball and bringing the arm in under and hitting it on the other side again, you know, and you can do that on a small bit of money. The schools do have some playgrounds, and the Buddhist temples allow the children to play, but otherwise there's quite a scarcity of playground. The safest time to cross the street is at 6 o'clock in the morning. But the fact that there is so much traffic is evidence of prosperity. I did not see any donkey carts in Japan, nor any ox carts. I did in Korea, but not in Japan. The missionaries told me that they were very common 15 years ago, but they're not now. There must be money in Japan. I was taken to an art store and was told that original prints cost $25. I said, "Why, who can pay for it?" "Ooh, lots of people can pay for it." And the newspapers complained the Japanese tourists abroad were spending more money than the foreign tourists were spending in Japan. And there was therefore a consideration of how to attract more tourists to Japan. They're very much hoping that the World's Fair in 70 at Osaka will bring in 30 million people. They're building with that in mind, but some people are afraid they'll go in the hole, because what will they do with all the buildings when they get through with it? The traffic, then, is indicative of prosperity. The railroads are magnificent. The express line from Osaka to Tokyo goes at about 100 miles an hour. It's smooth. There is a buffet. No tables. You sit up to the counter. You get an excellent meal with only one or two choices. And that price is quite as cheap as outside. And no tips. No tips anywhere in Japan. Not for taxis or hotels or anywhere else. It's marvelous to know precisely where you are. Then there's the monorail. I didn't ride in that, but I got to see it. It hangs down over the track about 3 feet on each side. I suppose that helps on balancing, but I saw it go zooming along. They're certainly far ahead of Connecticut when it comes to transportation. The New Haven Railroad is a disgrace. The prosperity is, of course, due to industry. The Japanese have had the lead for some time in cameras. Now they have it in motorcycles. The Honda is extremely popular, and they have little Hondas about the size of bicycles. and these things go zooming in and out. It is said that they may soon take the lead on watches. But at any rate, industrialization has gone far, and Japan is enjoying a great measure of prosperity. One observes that in the stores, they've got practically everything that you may wish. Many of the department stores look like Woolworths with the labels changed. And most of the labels are English words turned into Japanese equivalents. They're a bit puzzling at first because, you know, in Japanese, you cannot have a consonant by itself without a vowel following. So you cannot have three consonants in a row like street, S-T-R. You'd have to have sutore, sutorito would be street. You can stick a vowel after each of those consonants, you see. And, of course, the L turns into an R. Hotel is hoteru. You get some funny consequences on the airplane. I heard, this is Japan Airlines. Observe no smoking. We hope you will have a pleasant fright. I carefully dug out the hiragana on a label of a bottle that I had purchased. And I spelled it out. It read, Isto Tanto Kohi, which is instant coffee. Many words are a bit confusing because they're pronounced a little differently. I went into a grocery store and I asked for jam. Do you know anything about jam? I pointed to it. Oh, jam! But one gets used to little things like that. The point is you can find practically everything in the stores. The only thing I had any trouble in finding was steel wool. They had Dutch cleanser, and they had these bristle brushes, you know, but steel wool was a problem. I finally did find some, but I had to hunt a long time. And dried fruits were hard to find. A few grocery stores had them, but an abundance of fresh fruit of all sorts. But on the whole, stores are very well stocked. One surprising thing was that in practically all of the stores, they had mannequins for the clothes of men, women, and children, and all of them with blonde hair and Western faces. Only occasionally did I see a mannequin with a Japanese face, in case it was advertising a kimono. But of course, the people are wearing almost entirely Western clothes. You very seldom see a man in anything but Western clothes, unless he's a Buddhist priest. But the women are differentiated. The older ones still wear the kimonos. And I did a great deal of ogling of the ladies because of the designs on their kimonos. Sometimes a chrysanthemum, sometimes a heron, a pheasant, or a fan pattern, or a leaf pattern. Most exquisitely woven. It's a pity that the kimono is disappearing. Dress then also indicates a good deal of luxury. Food is abundant and economical if you go at the right place. The hotels which entertain the foreigners have prices just as high as they are in the United States. You pay $3 a meal at the Miyako Hotel, but at the Student Union, where they serve thousands of students, you can get a good curry rice and plenty of curry in it too for 19 cents. But it's rather peculiar that a cup of coffee would be 25 American cents. You can get a whole meal for less than a cup of coffee. Why it's more expensive, I don't know. But at any rate, food is abundant and tasty. And incidentally, raw fish doesn't taste like fish. It tasted more like jello to me. So then, in traffic, in all of the supplies, in department stores, when it comes to dress and to food, there are evidences of prosperity. At the same time, there are slums. I was taken to Kobe, to the area where Kagawa began, and was told that perhaps the slums are worse than they were in his day, because the whole region was devastated in the war and then rebuilt afterwards rapidly and out of the meanest of materials in very shabby fashion. Just toothpick houses. And the congestion there is frightful. I saw an apartment house built by the Catholics, and I estimated that it would house about three families, but it had 11 television aerials, and I was told that each would serve about three families. The institute which I was visiting was a high building. It's sort of a social settlement, and we looked down from there, and they pointed to a little house down below, which recently, its predecessor recently, had burned. They said that they had offered to house the dislocated inhabitants and put at their disposal the Kagawa room, which had 16 mat beds. They thought that would take care of the whole situation, but 67 persons turned up living in that little shanty. This area is still the center for prostitutes and for narcotics, and my friend told me that 5 years in prison doesn't cure a narcotic. He goes straight back to it, but of course, what else has he got to go back to? So the slum situation there, at any rate, is as bad as ever it was. Japan, moreover, has its classes against whom there is discrimination. I suppose that we only were guilty on that score, but there are two groups in Japan who are subject to an inferior status, and the first group is the Koreans. They were brought into Japan during the period of the Japanese occupation of Korea, brought in for labor. They have remained in Japan. There is a new generation which now speaks Japanese and not Korean, so that it's a difficult matter for them to go back to Korea, should they so wish. They cannot become Japanese citizens. They are restricted in matters of economic activity. They must trade with each other or with firms in Korea. So here is a whole class against which there is discriminatory legislation and status. And the other one is the Eta. I'd never heard of the Eta. The Eta were a group of people who were deliberately picked out by the old shoguns to do the distasteful kind of work which no one else was willing to undertake, namely, anything having to do with the shedding of blood or with corpses. These people were to be the public executioners, they were to be the butchers, they were to be the tanners, and they were to handle anything that had to do with leather. Today, they live together. Some of them are prosperous because they have the shoe industry. It's leather. And the shoe industry is often becoming plastic, but it still remains in their hands nevertheless. So some of them have a degree of prosperity, but they cannot intermarry with any others. And when a marriage is proposed, there will be an investigation of the genealogy to see whether there's any Eta blood. They have intermarried to a degree that already they have some distinguishable characteristics. Sometimes they try to remove it by a surgery. In the Meiji era, the whole status of the Eta was abolished legally, but nevertheless, you can't reform people simply by legislation, and the distinction goes on. In Kobe, I had pointed out to me two orphanages, one for the poor children of the respectable and the other for children of the Eta. As far as their economic status is concerned, they're on the same level. But the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Their children cannot even go to the same nurseries. I was introduced also in Kobe to the work which is being done for the key children. They're called key children because they wear keys around their necks to let them into the house when they get home, because their fathers are unknown and their mothers have to work. So they're at the nursery all day, and when they go home, they let themselves in. They crave affection. I've got some drawings of them over there. Two little children taking their naps and one reaching a hand over to the other one, another one being comforted by a nurse. Then there is another class whose situation is the worst in Japan, and that is the illegitimate children of American soldiers and Japanese women. They have no status in Japanese society. The doors are closed to them. There would be less discrimination against them in the United States than in Japan. And it's really our responsibility to adopt them in one way or another and bring them over here. Over there, there's no chance. I visited a school also for retarded children where handicrafts of various kinds were being conducted, and saw one very interesting feature. For some friend of the school had cast in concrete a huge elephant and made a slide down its trunk. I've got a drawing there. They go up the back edge of the elephant, over the tail and across the back, and they do whoop down the elephant's trunk. And they love that much more than any of our manufactured slides. Well, this was a little glimpse in one city of Eta, Koreans, key children, retarded children, congested population, all of this kind of thing in the center of a great city. A tourist wouldn't see it. I saw it because the director of that institute was a student of the Divinity School, and he invited me to come and speak to two groups of young people, 500 of them at a time. And he wanted me to discuss the war in Vietnam. And I did it. And we didn't have a riot. I didn't say anything that would occasion a riot, but I tried to analyze the whole situation. I let it be known that I had participated in protests in the United States, but I was not going to indulge in any wild denunciation of those who may very well have lost lofty, but I think misguided motives. They listened respectfully. As I say, this is the kind of thing that one could get to see only through a church connection. A tourist wouldn't make it. It's the Christian bodies who are taking hold of situations like this. So there is wealth and there is poverty. One often finds them conjoined, same sort of thing in South America. Great wealth and abject poverty, and so too in Japan. Then I was taken to the countryside. One of our graduates is at Wakayama in a rural district, and he took me to see a farm. Once again, the contacts through these missionaries were such as one would not easily otherwise acquire. He took me to see a farmer who was using the old farmhouse. It had a chimney big enough for three Santa Clauses. But beneath it, of course, the stove, which he was still using, and it was fueled by propane. He took me out to his stable. It was empty. He had no cattle. He used commercial fertilizer. He took me to see his tangerine farm, which was on a very steep hillside. And to take the fertilizer up to the top and to bring the tangerines down, he had a lift, and it was run with gasoline. Gasoline has become the donkey of Japan, in the countryside as well as in the cities. What is going to become of the countryside is very much of a question. The papers are complaining that in the cities they have an overpopulation problem, and in the country it's an underpopulation. The young people are leaving, and the old grandmas sit at home without sons and without grandsons. And dikes are neglected. Everything begins to run down in the country area. The country is being deserted. On the other hand, I saw some farmhouses which looked elegant. They had their TVs and all the rest of it. Some farmers were prospering. So mechanization is, to some extent, it's doing two things. On the one hand, it's drawing the people from the farms into the cities to go into the factories. On the other hand, it's making them less necessary because mechanization is taking over some of their labor. But there's one great area where it hasn't done it, and that's the rice field. These are underwater all the time, you know, and by hand, people have to put every plant in the row. And if there's a typhoon and silt goes over it, as recently happened, and these plants are uprooted, they have to put them all back again by hand, and when they're ripe, all of the reaping is done in the same way. Now in California, I found that the rice is sown by a bombardment of pellets from a helicopter without any attention to rows, because when they come to harvest, they drain the field, let it dry, and then go with the machine and reap the whole thing. Now that is almost certain to come in Japan before too long, because they catch up with every mechanical development in very short order. If that happens, then there'll be a large measure of the population dislocated. But it's also a question as to how that change can come about. So far as I can see, there are only two possibilities. One is a socialized state, or even communism, which would unify all of those farms, because obviously one farmer couldn't engage a helicopter. The other possibility would be voluntary farmers cooperatives, which would agree to put a lot of farms together for the purpose. So the drive is almost certainly going to be toward some kind of consolidation of agriculture with a reduction of the personnel involved. Now, of course, this is happening in our own country, and I think we ought to look at it more seriously than perhaps we do. We seem to think that the secular city is the great new phenomenon. There's nothing new about a city. We've had cities as old as Nineveh and Tyre. Rome had a population of 1.5 million in the time of Christ. The gospel spread all through the cities of Asia Minor. The city is an ancient phenomenon. And Tokyo in the old imperial days had 1 million inhabitants. What's new is the disappearance of the countryside. My son-in-law, who was here last week, Roger Robison, who is now the Methodist District Superintendent for Southern Montana, went out there to be a rural pastor. He got out there and found that his farmers were working 7 weeks out of the year, 2 to sow and 5 to reap. They used commercial fertilizer. They did not live on the land. And the best place to meet the farmers was at 9 o'clock in the morning in the coffee shop. The problem of the church was to find leisure activity for farmers. He got them all to build a church. When you get the church built, what do you do then? Probably better start a Camp Holden and put them all to work on that. What I'm trying to do is to indicate that changes are underway which lag maybe 25 years in Japan. But the sort of thing that's happened here and is happening more rapidly, Montana's reached that stage, Mississippi hasn't, it will, that's going to come over there too. And the church is here and the church is there when they are studying how to meet the sociological situation should be very much alive to drifts of this kind and what they are doing to peoples. So you've got prosperity and poverty. Concentration in cities and huge development of industry. Already a decline in the rural areas because of the move to the city and mechanization, with a lot more of it probably still to come. Now, so far I have dealt with the external aspects of life, and now briefly about some of the cultural aspects. There is a very great avidity in Japan to appropriate everything of validity and interest and concern in the rest of the world, and particularly in the Western world. Japan used to be oriented toward China, but because of the bamboo curtain, that is not possible at the moment, though many Japanese hope it will be again. Since the Meiji era, they've been turned toward the West, Germany largely at first, now primarily the United States. But all the world, and they're ready to absorb anything and everything. I was simply amazed at the expositions which were on display in various parts of Japan. In Kyoto, they had an exposition of the paintings of Utrillo and then of Yugoslavian icons of the 9th, 10th, 12th, and 13th centuries. They all had English captions. And the one of Doubting Thomas putting his finger into Christ's side was labeled St. Tom's Treachery. Well, obviously, the man who did it didn't know anything about what it meant, but he was interested. It was an old icon who came from Yugoslavia, and it must be interesting. At Osaka, they had an exhibition of first editions of Grimm's Fairy Tales. One day on the train, I saw a crowd, and I thought, now, just exactly who would they be? I tried to snoop up on them and hear what language they were talking. I knew it wasn't Japanese, but I couldn't get quite close enough to tell. Until we got off the train, and then I heard Spanish. I said, ah, queridos amigos! Then they just all warmed up. They were Spanish dancers from Brazil. With their musical, not Brazil, I mean Madrid, with their musical instruments, putting on dancing and singing. And it was in Sendai on that occasion. And then they have even more outlandish things than that. The Yale Glee Club comes. And sometimes even the Harvard Glee Club. and various symphony orchestras. All this kind of thing is going on. And then, largely, I think, through Western influence, they become interested in Japanese antiquities. In the Meiji period, in the late 19th century, the Emperor Meiji was much attracted toward the West, opened up the channels of communication, and encouraged borrowing from the Occident. There was a general despising of Japan's past, and antiquities were just tossed around. You could pick them up, I'm told, for a few yen. But then there were Japanese who came to Europe and found that the Europeans were interested in their own antiquities. I met Yoshiro, who first went to Italy and wrote a book on Botticelli, and then taught the history of Western art at China, at Harvard. Then it occurred to him he ought to pay some attention to the history of Japanese art. He's gone back to Nara and has founded a magnificent museum for Japanese antiquities. It is something of an innovation by way of a museum. It seems to me, in a sense, to be a return to the Middle Ages. Because in the Middle Ages, pictures had settings. They weren't all stuck in rows around a wall. They fitted into a church, or a rathouse, or a private home. Now, he can't get away from the museum idea if he has a great many Japanese prints, though sometimes he fills up a complete wall with Japanese mural embroideries or prints. He has also cases for antiquities, but he's done two things that create a setting better than one ordinarily has. First of all, a full glass front and a veranda looking out over a superb lake. Then in the center of his museum, he has an enclosure in which great bamboo trees are growing from the first floor up through the third, surrounded on every floor by glass, so that no matter where you are, you look upon the bamboo. So you wander through these galleries looking on the lake without and the bamboo within, and although pictures are side by side, yet you feel that a certain environment has been created to receive them. I haven't seen an American museum, perhaps I'm too ignorant to know, but I haven't seen one that seemed to me to have combined the indigenous locale for a picture in nevertheless an assembly of pictures. I had nearly an hour or so talk with him. He was extremely gracious. Talked about what he was doing and the theory of it and so on. He had dedicated himself to doing for Japan what others had done for the West, and doing it in a very unusual way. Kyoto has also now a museum of Japanese antiquities, and of course their antiquities are antiquities. The thing isn't very old if it only goes back to 800 or 600. They begin with the prehistoric and come right down the line. So there is a concern on the part of the Japanese, both for everything from the West and for their own tradition. I think that's more so in connection with museums than with music. I didn't attend many musicals. I did attend a children's recital and at a Catholic school a concert, but on these occasions the music was all Western. They had Bach, Brahms, Beethoven, Mendelssohn, Mozart, Stravinsky, and Tchaikovsky. But I don't think there was a Japanese composer anywhere on the program. Now, perhaps a symphony orchestra would have some Japanese composers. Incidentally, all of the hymns in the hymn books, with very rare exceptions, are translations from the West. So in the realm of music, I didn't feel that there was as much that was new, but that may be just my ignorance. In the case of art, I visited the Museum of Modern Art, and some of it was the kind of thing that you could see just as well in Nairobi or Buenos Aires. The modern artists think they're so original, but the themes they use run all over the world. On the other hand, there were some instances in which the artist had taken an old Japanese motif and had handled it in a quite original way. For example, There was one print of waves. Now, the Japanese were very fond of doing waves with little curlicues on the end, you know. But what had happened this time was that the man had made a combination of the convex and the concave turning over each other, and had put ribs inside the waves, almost like the tiles on a roof. In fact, you got something of the impression with the waves that you did in looking over a city and seeing all the patterns of the roofs. They wove in and out each other in an intricate and very intriguing fashion. Then sometimes bird forms would be used. The Japanese were very fond of the pheasant and the peacock, the stork, the goose, and the rooster. Well, these come up again in some of the modern patterns with very gorgeous color effects in the feathers and so on. Well, in other words, in some respects I found an originality in the modern art, and others it seemed to me the kind of thing you could see anywhere. So here we have music and art. With regard to drama, they make a great deal of the old forms, and some of them just as they were. The no plays go back so far that the language is as remote to the modern Japanese as Chaucer would be to us. The action is extremely slow, and to a Western barbarian like me, a bit tiresome. It began at 10:30 in the morning. It didn't end until 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I went out for lunch and didn't come back. The parts are not exactly spoken, they're droned. It sounds like a blending of Gregorian chants and the howling of coyotes. The Japanese will sit there and take it in all day long. It evidently means a lot to them. But I just felt like, as a goth might have felt if he'd strolled into Hagia Sophia at Constantinople and seen all of that gorgeous liturgy and wondered what it was all about. I didn't know. The kabuki plays are different. They have a lot of action, highly dramatic. Sometimes they use old themes, but I suspect with certain modern overtones. The play I saw was on the rebellion of a granddaughter against a marriage arranged by her grandfather. That could happen in the old days, but I suspected a little bit of the dialogue might have been tinged between the with regard to the conflict between the present generations. So the kabuki plays are sometimes quite modern, sometimes use themes from old Japan, but give them a modern turn. The mibu plays are simply pantomime. Not a word is said. There are about 30 of these, and the plots are well known to the audience, so they don't need any explanation. And the actors have a great deal of skill in taking off all the motions, of course. They're all garbed and they're all masked. But even so, I didn't find it too exciting. But the people about me obviously did. I've got some drawings there of one toothless old man with bare feet sitting up in the gallery watching this play most intently. Then there are the puppet plays. The puppets are life-size, manipulated by three men, two of whom have black masks, the other has an exposed face. These puppets can move their hands and their eyes and their eyebrows and can just quiver with passion. And the audience claps uproariously when they see them shaking with emotion in this fashion. They say it takes 4 years of training for the three performers to get their emotions properly correlated on the puppet. And I'm told that probably puppetry of this kind will die out because the young Japanese are not willing to work that long. But I asked them, I said, why do you do it anyway? They said, why, it's easier to kill a puppet and throw his corpse over the wall than if you got a live man. But I said, well, we simulate murders and suicides and harikari and anything else on our stage. I don't see why you've got to have puppets to do it. Well, it's traditional, and they like it partly for that reason, and it's amazingly skillful. But as drama, I don't know. Of course, these puppies don't say anything. There's a narrator on the side, and he just tears himself to tatters as he narrates a terrible tragedy. His voice is about gone after 20 minutes. They had to get in somebody to replace him for the next play. Well, anyway, there's a lively interest in the drama. As for the cinema, I didn't go. I saw the signs out in front, and they looked just about as sexy and as violent as anything you could find in the worst examples in the United States. But I'm told that they have some very beautiful historical cinemas in which they do take the setting in the old temples and shrines and use perhaps an ancient plot. And with cameras, you could probably get better effects than you could from visiting the old temples. So the movie, on the one hand, is highly modernized in the Hollywood sense, and on the other does some very beautiful historical work. These are some of the cultural interests which are very avidly pursued. And then come universities. Somebody asked me what struck me most about Japan, and I said this, that everything is small in Japan except the universities. They have to have from 15,000 to 20,000 in attendance, even the state universities, because they're supported by tuition. I don't know why the state doesn't give them enough to make that unnecessary. Perhaps it is that they put their extra money into apparatus for the sciences and so on, because it's only the state institutions that can do much with regard to the sciences. But when they're all supported by tuition, they've got to have that many students to have enough money. So Doshishi has 20,000. The University of Kyoto, which is state-supported, has been able to cut down to 15,000. I think the only university that has no more than 1,000 is the International Christian University in Kyoto, which is subsidized from America. And at Sendai and Hokkaido and various other places that I visited, they all have these appallingly large numbers. The students complain that they have no faculty-student relations. There's a great deal of ferment going on in the universities, strikes and agitations which make Berkeley look pale. I was told there may be a psychological explanation that when you have so many students, you can't integrate them and give them any sense of cohesion unless they can become passionately excited about a cause, no matter what it is. For a while, it was anti-Vietnam, and now it's mainly anti-administration. Somebody suggested the thing to do would be to get the Russians to found a university and let all the radicals go over to that university and fight with its administration. But obviously, this is not a very feasible way out. You'd be amazed at some of the things they quarrel over. At Doshishi, where I was, the latest quarrel was about having to pay for utilities in the student dormitories in addition to rent, despite the fact that the utilities and the rent put together were cheaper than what they could get anywhere else. But they said the rent ought to include everything. The university argued that the student should be charged for what he actually spent, for light or for some other utility. So they had a big strike over this. I don't precisely see what a strike could do if you merely stayed away from class. I'll tell you in a minute about ICU, where they did a whole lot worse than that. But they did use physical violence against members of the faculty, and the dean of the divinity school at Doshishi would have been mauled if several of his colleagues hadn't rushed in to pull him out of the melee. They'd just go in for a rough and tumble. Don't care if they break a jaw or two. But the faculties, while the students exaggerate the rebellion of the young generation against the old remains paternalistic. And the faculty feel that if a student is once let in, they ought to get him honorably out. So they have told these students repeatedly that if they didn't pay their bills, they would be dropped. And then the date for dropping would be postponed and postponed and postponed and postponed. Finally, they clamped down, dropped them all, and then reinstated them the next day. And the deans, out of their own pockets, paid up the deficiency on their bills. You shake your head. You have good reason to. Some of the missionaries are very indignant because they say there's no backbone in the faculties. They have the old paternalistic feeling that somehow or other they got to see them through. I think with us, what we'd say, all right, you don't, if you don't want to pay, you won't get your degree, and that's that. Well, now at ICU, the thing got a lot worse. The protest there began because the students objected to examinations, aptitude tests, which were approved by the Department of Education of the government. And they said if the government approved of it, it must be a trick in order to catch reds. The faculty of ICU said, all right, we'll give up that form of examination. But then they penalized the students who had struck. That was a tactical blunder, because there were only about some 40 of them. But then all of the 1,000 students struck in order to defend the right to strike. They said they've won their point. You shouldn't penalize them. So then the strike got more drastic. And then a group of about 40 students went in and simply took over the building. There was only one building, a huge building, but they took the whole thing over and ensconced themselves in its rooms, had food smuggled into them by fellow students, and if any student or faculty member approached, pelted him with bottles or whatsoever laid a hand. They tied up the entire university and closed it. It was closed down for months. Finally, it was reopened for seniors and foreign students, and it will be reopened in the fall, but a whole year's work, nearly, for most students has been lost. But then their demands became more radical. They said it should not be called international, but only Japanese, not Christian, because you can't have a Christian university, because you ought to get experts whether they're Christians or not. And also they wanted to sever the American connection. Well, if they do and lose the financial support, they'll have to have perhaps 20,000 students, and it'll be just like all the others. No, maybe the only thing to do is let them do it that way, if they have such a feeling against it. The only thing America could do then, I think, would be to give scholarships to be accepted or rejected on an individual basis by the student. But then there's also, among these radicals, a small core, communist-inspired, who are using the universities as a base to agitate for the non-renewal of the treaty with the United States in 1970. And everything is building up, and probably the demonstrations will get a lot more violent as 1970 approaches. Well, now that kind of ferment is going on in the universities all over Japan. And there are constant parades and people through loudspeakers blasting away to the students who assemble in great hordes on the campus and listen to this. There are huge posters in Japanese put up one day after the other, leaning so big that they have to lean against trees. You have just a feeling of ferment all the time. Now, out of 20,000 students, I suppose there might not be more than a few hundred who are doing this all the time, but still it keeps things in a rather excited state. But excellent academic work takes place. The faculties have very largely been trained abroad. Nearly all of them can speak English. Some speak German better, occasionally French. But for the most part, they speak English. The students, by the way, have had English in elementary schools, and some have learned it. But few of them sufficiently to understand a lecture or to engage in a continuous conversation. But some can. I gave one lecture at the University of Kyoto, and I noticed a nun in the audience. She called me up afterwards, spoke a beautiful English, but she was Japanese. She'd never been in this country. She'd learned it all in that Catholic school from American nuns from St. Louis. She spoke beautifully. And she wanted me to help her with a dissertation on medieval heresy. So I could tell her quite a lot about heretics. Well, my point is that she spoke English beautifully. Some do. The majority, not well enough for a continuous conversation. And I did not speak Japanese for more than shopping and travel. And I could not understand my interpreters. If they waved their hands more than I did, I might ask them whether they were putting in something that I hadn't said. I did get to be able to josh them a little bit, and that helped. But I confess that when I began with interpreters, and audiences looked at me with the earnest expectation of the sons of God, waiting for the creation to travail and groan, I felt like groaning myself. It just seemed so blank. But after a while, I began to get a greater sense of rapport, and by the time of ending up, I could feel some kind of audience response. And the interpreters were excellent. There is a very high level of intellectual life in Japan, and many of their scholars are eminent. In the Divinity School, there is a very excellent faculty. Incidentally, the man who has just translated the New Testament into modern vernacular Japanese is one to whom I taught his Greek 40 years ago at the Yale Divinity School. And the pastor of the college church was my student about 40 years ago. I say they have a fine faculty. And the library perfectly amazed me. You know, they've got the whole of the Weimar edition of Luther, and they've got the Corpus Reformatorum and Minis Patrologia, and the Corpus Reformatorum, Corpus Scriptorum Ecclesiasticorum Latinorum, und die griechische christliche Schriftstelle der ersten drei Jahrhunderten. They got all of these, and it doesn't matter whether it's Greek, Latin, or German, or whatnot. I was amazed at their library. And there's a high quality of academic achievement. With regard to religion and theology, there are two books on Japanese theology, one by Michelson and one by Germany. They feel that there is something distinctive, despite the fact that Japanese theology was largely Barthian for a long time. That's one reason why Brunner was not received with great acclaim when he first came. He spent 2 years there. But in the end, they felt great personal affection for him and were much more receptive to his ideas. But is there anything distinctively Japanese? There are those who feel that a book entitled The Pain of God is distinctive. Now, of course, in the early church, there were those who talked about, called patripassionists, who held that God the Father suffered, and their view was rejected on the ground that it was God the Son who suffered. Of course, Luther has the conflict in God between his wrath and his mercy. But this book does bring out more acutely the identification of God the Father with God the Son in suffering. This may be a distinctively Japanese note. In all the sermons that I heard, the emphasis was on sacrifice. Follow the suffering Christ. Devote yourself to some sacrificial endeavor, with illustrations taken from Kagawa and various others of that kind. And one must remember that the ministry is highly sacrificial for those boys. If they went into economics or politics, they could have high-paying jobs. They go into the ministry and they'll have a bare subsistence and may have to take jobs on the side to eke it out. They are a minority. They've had direct persecution in the past. They may suffer a certain measure of social ostracism from their families if they're of another religion. It does require a personal stand, a personal loyalty, and a genuine sacrifice to be a Japanese pastor. And one often finds greater religious vitality where the cost is high than in a land where our own, where it lays no very heavy burden upon us. In their art, a lot of Christian art has lately developed and has been collected by Takanaka in a book just published in Japanese, which will come out in English, but nearly all of it is on the New Testament. That's rather interesting, that there are some fine professional Japanese artists. Watanabe is one, Fujishiro is another, who are highly esteemed in the world of art. They have turned to biblical themes. And Watanabe in particular reminds one of early medieval miniatures. There's a certain simplicity and naivete and grace about his figures which are suggestive of a certain wistful piety. I think perhaps there's more distinctiveness in Japanese religious art than there is in Japanese theology. In the chapel at Doshishi, they do not have the cross, but suspended from the ceiling is the crown of thorns. I reminded them that they had revived one of the instruments of the Passion. They were going back to the art of the 13th century. But very probably it is because of the suffering in which they are involved. I went into various parts of Japan, and then I had nearly a week in Korea. Here there is greater poverty. One sees ox carts frequently. Greater contrasts of wealth and poverty. I was entertained in one home, in the home of a man whose daughter I had married in this country. Incidentally, the two sets of parents were there, male attendants at the wedding in the States had just come home. So here was a party with the father and mother of the bride and of the groom and the two attendants. He is a Christian and a Presbyterian. He is in the oil business, has an exquisite house, as beautiful as a museum, with tapestries and pictures, with an interior garden with tropical plants, and he treats everyone as if it is a child and gives it individual attention on fertilizer and soil and water and temperature, and outside another exquisite garden. Then you go down to the riverbank and see rows and rows of shanties which look as if they have been made out of toothpicks, and they are inhabited by the refugees from North Korea. But some of the refugees are well-to-do. They have a church which began with 29 members and now has 9,000. And they have built a great edifice which, with its surrounding buildings and the loudspeaker passing it out, will house 3,000 at a time. They have three services on Sunday morning, each time attended by 3,000. And to hear them sing the old gospel hymns, the tunes only I understood, 3,000 of them, and to realize that they are all refugees primarily because of religion. I was moved to tears. They have 22 ministers, deacons in charge of every section of the city, and that congregation of 9,000 is divided up into bands of 10, 900 bands of 10, so that they have largeness and intimacy at the same time. To come back to Japan, just a word or two now about personal relations. One finds among all peoples roughness and kindness, courtesy and gruffness. I never met anything that was discourteous. I've seen Japanese a bit rough with each other on occasion. I met with rather surprising courtesies. And one day I was in an alley sketching. I felt somebody over my shoulder looking. I turned around, and it was a policeman. I thought, oh, my stars, what have I done? But when he saw what I was doing, he disappeared and came back after a few minutes and brought me a chair. And then a story was printed in Life's Asian edition for last May, which illustrated how, in the midst of the brutalities of war, there could be courtesy and kindness. Incidentally, the Japanese have a deep sense of guilt for what they did in the war to the Koreans and to the peoples all the way down to Singapore. They make church resolutions like the Barman Declaration, confessing their guilt. This story was written by an Australian journalist who was captured by the Japanese and in a prison camp in Singapore. Word came to him that the Japanese officer in charge of the camp wished to see him. He wondered what it was all about. The Japanese officer said to him, I hear that you're a writer. He said, well, not exactly, a journalist. And then he bit his tongue because he had heard the journalists in particular were put under pressure to write something against their own countries. He stiffened. The Japanese officer said he would like to have a chance to talk with him about Western literature and so on. The Australian suspected that he was going to be grilled to get military information or something to the disadvantage of his country out of him. He froze until it became apparent to him that this Japanese was quite sincere. He spoke English well. He was interested in Western culture and art. He wanted to get away from the hideousness of this whole business and talk with prisoners on another level. The prisoners were dying from malnutrition. The camp doctor told this Australian that he couldn't expect to live more than another month. At that point, the Japanese officer was transferred to another assignment. The day after he was gone, the Australian found under his pillow $100 Japanese Malayan note. With it, he was able to buy on the black market enough fish to save himself and two of his buddies. He knew the name of that Japanese officer. When the war was over, he investigated and found that he was living in Osaka. He went to see him. When they met in totally un-Japanese fashion, they embraced. The former Japanese officer took him home and introduced him to his mother. The American tried to tell her what her son had done for him and of the money under his pillow. And the Japanese said, "I don't remember it. It must have fallen out of my pocket." And said the Australian, "And it crept under my pillow?" Thus one finds brutality in all peoples, including ourselves. But kindness and courtesy, consideration, respect, and affection. I was given so many warm farewells that I was reminded of the case of a missionary who was given so many farewells that the last one had to be posthumous. But I did survive the last one and came away enlarged in my horizons, warmed in my heart, and inspired for a new endeavor. Now, these are my drawings. These drawings are put up with clothespins because they're on both sides of the page. So there's something on the other side of the fence. I didn't want to carry too much, and so I pasted them on both sides. I might say that in this...